May I have the envelope, please?
And the Oscar for Best Picture is presented to...
And the Oscar goes 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 to...
And the Oscar goes...
And the Oscar goes...
And the Oscar goes to...
The Oscar goes to...
The Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
The Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes...
Welcome to a very special edition of... And the award goes to, I'm Luke Shoemaker.
And I'm Zach King.
Last time, Zach and I made history with Kathryn Bigelow and The Hurt Locker. This time, we'll be ranking our top 10 movies from the first decade of this century. Zach, this will be very different for our listeners in terms of structure, but let's open with a discussion on the film industry during this decade, just an overall opening thoughts about from 2000 to 2009.
For me, as we went through the early years of, let's say, from 2000 to really 2007 is where it kind of peaked for me, and you'll see that reflected in my top 10. Man, it was just so fun for me going through those films from 2000 to really 05, 06. A lot of films that I hadn't seen that ended up in both our snubs, films that were Best Picture nominees that I somehow missed. You know, it was just, it was a lot of fun being reminded, not only rewatching films that I had seen from that era that I adored, but just being reminded of that time when I first watched them, as we would share on the pod, and you know, that time in my childhood or that time in adolescence, it was just all good memories for me, honestly. And I really appreciated that part of it, along with obviously the quality that we come through, you know, the quality of films that we've been talking about.
That was definitely interesting to go back and rewatch movies through like an adult eye instead of a child eye or a teenage eye, because, you know, your life has sculpted our reality. And a lot of those movies I had a different appreciation for, or for some of them I thought maybe they weren't as good as I once thought. And it was interesting to go back. And like you said, there are several movies we missed, or I missed, from 2000 to 04, because I would have been 10 to, you know, around 14. So some of them would have I swung and missed on, or they weren't as available as they are to us now. I will say, for me, one of the biggest takeaways is just, I think, how transformational this decade was as far as what they could do with a movie digitally. I think I compare it to the 90s. You know, I think about Moore's Law talks about technology doubling every 2 years, and you look at movies in the 90s, and then boom, the effects and everything. I mean, we talked about in Gladiator, Proximo died in filming, and you can't even tell his face is CGI'd. It was like such a, I mean, it gave birth to like the Matrix trilogy. You think of something like that, where it was just, you'd never seen anything like that before. And I know every decade has groundbreaking things come through, but I feel like this decade was like the biggest leap between 80s, 90s to that.
Yeah. When you put it in historical perspective, like you're doing, the 90s in a lot of people's mind and in my mind is a glorious decade for film. It really was revolutionary in a lot of ways, changed the game, and you have classics upon classics. And then this decade, like you're saying, all the technological advancements within the industry on top of the quality of films, it's really impressive how it kind of it pushed the industry forward. And then I'm going to argue this next decade coming up that we're going to go through on the pods. Wow. The 2010s.
Oh, it does. Yeah. I mean, it's the same thing. It's this doubling effect, because yeah, I think as far as computers went, in the 90s, you had less and less people with like a powerful computer. And then 2000s is when I started to realize more and more of my friends and I had a personal computer. And then, you know, now look where we're at. I mean, we carry them in our pocket every day.
Yeah, it's changed the game, definitely. Information technology, the flow of information, and yeah, technology in general. I'm with you. It's it's breathtaking to look back, like I said, on the 90s and now this decade that we're about to jump into. And I've really enjoyed it. It's been a great reminder of, you know, the quality that's out there in filmmaking during that time.
I also like when I looked at your list and my list, and then just started thinking about some of the movies, so even our last movie, of how like world events shaped some of this decade. Because boom, 01, you have 9/11, and then boom, Iraq War. And then it was like, I mean, you've got 25th Hour listed. That was like, I think for me, I think it was one of the first like 9/11 kind of, it shows like where Ground Zero was. But then it was like United 93, we talked about Valley of Allah and Hurt Locker and all these different movies. It was like the political landscape started to shape movies a little bit. I thought that was interesting.
Definitely. It was such a, you know, transformative era in politics and America, just history in general, the world events that happen. Absolutely. That always plays into film, and I admire the filmmakers that have pulled off, you know, sharing that part of history, the Hollywood version, you know, if you will. But either way, very impressive. Why don't we review our award winners, though, from the decade, from the pod?
Let's go. First, give us some interesting details on how you and I selected over that decade.
Yeah, so I just kind of wanted to go by the numbers, as they say, as far as if we sided with the Academy, if we, you know, went with the snub for Best Picture winner. So this is what I came up with, Luke. I sided with the Academy 5 out of 10 times in the year 2000s, in this decade we're covering. So 5 out of 10 times I said, yes, the Academy was right. You also sided with the Academy 5 times. So we're even there. It's interesting.
It's about to get rogue, though.
So here's where it gets a little interesting. Only one time did I pick a winner that was outside of the Academy's original 5 nominees. I rarely broke from the field, my friend. You, however, picked 4 winners that were not previously nominated by the Academy for Best Picture.
I'm a rogue, man. I'm a gambler. I just throw it out there, just, you know.
The wild card, like you said. And I appreciate that, because when we get in, you know, we're about to break down each year in the picks. I respect them. Like I said, every time, and you can go back to the pods, I said every time, like, hey, I respect that choice. If that would have been the pick, I wouldn't have thrown a fit. So.
Yeah, well, I'll start with 2000. We discussed American Beauty. You went with American Beauty, and I went with Fight Club. Right off the bat, I went pretty rogue there. I don't think in 2000 I that would have been my vote, but I just think retrospectively, that's just where I felt that movie was. I mean, you and I sat down and watched it together recently, and just a good film.
Well, man, I wish I had rewatched it for that pod and on top of American Beauty, which I did watch, because not only should it have been a Best Picture nominee, which we agreed on in that pod, man, it's perfection in every sense of the word, because it's Fincher. And then we discussed its legacy on that pod. Why didn't it age well? Why didn't it get the recognition? Well, it had the worst marketing campaign ever, you know, through WWE commercials and whatnot. And that was a big part of it. And yeah, not being able to market it properly, and it didn't make a lot of money, but then it is a cult. It now has the cult. It is a cult classic movie. It has a cult following. And today it is appreciated far more than it was then. And that's just a shame.
Way too early.
Yeah, I think I would still go American Beauty on, you know, reflecting back, but man, it's just continued how much I think of Fincher, and he's elevated his spot in my top 5, basically. Yeah. 2001 was pretty easy, though, Luke.
Yeah.
Gladiator was the winner, and we both went Gladiator, and I don't feel bad about that. Do you?
No, that was a solid lock for me, and I think for a lot of our listeners, that's a movie that there wasn't going to be a lot of argument even today when you go back and watch it.
And Ridley's a guy who needs a best director win.
Hey, and here's something I started to think about with this decade. You know, so far we've talked about two pretty unique stories as far as It's not necessarily a sequel, reboot, any of that stuff. But I really started thinking about this decade. I always bag on where we're at now in movies, but it was really this decade that gave birth to franchises, and I just didn't really think of how many franchises started in this decade. You had Harry Potter's, which we're up to 8 or 10 of those, if you count Fantastic Beasts, Fast and Furious, the MCU. You had Saw. You had, like, this was really when they just started, let's just keep making sequels. And
Batman, Nolan, Spider-Man. Yeah. Well, you said wild. MCU. It's incredible that's when they all started to spawn. And I think that's reflective of the success, the box office success of the 90s and kind of the Jurassic Park, the franchise like that starting in the 90s. Yeah. I think that really,
Terminator,
really helped. And Star Wars kind of was like 98, 99, Phantom of the Menace. So, they were like, hey, it's time for our piece of the pie as well.
Yeah.
2002 was a fun pod, A Beautiful Mind, Ron Howard. Once again, Russell Crowe. I went with In the Bedroom. You went with
Memento. And I find this interesting because obviously both were very passionate about those choices because they may reappear later when we get into our 10.
Definitely will. And yeah, I'm very passionate about that choice. And yeah, I know you are too. And I would not change that one for the world.
No, and I think, Beautiful Mind, we both enjoyed it. We definitely both enjoyed watching it. It's just, there's something special about those two when we get into them. There was nothing special in 2003 for either of us in regards to the movie that we watched with Chicago. We both went off script there. I felt very passionate about Gangs of New York, but you were taken back by a special performance in a special movie.
Yeah, Roman Polanski's The Pianist with Adrian Brody's performance in that film. Like I said at the time, to me, it's the best Holocaust movie ever made, and I did watch Schindler's List to compare, and Schindler's List is a masterpiece too, taking nothing away from that. I just thought it deserved to win as well, and I love Scorsese, I love Gangs in New York, but it's just the movie that really, it haunts me to this day, and it always will.
There was going to be, no real argument. We had some reservations when we got into 2004 because of how great its predecessor was, but we had Lord of the Rings, Return of the King, the second time where you and I both agreed that the pod movie that we covered was also our pick for the award.
Yep, we agreed with the Academy, and our reservation being we prefer The Two Towers. We think it's a superior film, taking nothing away obviously from The Return of the King, which you'll see in a little bit. Hint, hint.
Yeah. What about 05? Total twist when we get into as far as tone of movies.
2005 was tough for me because Million Dollar Baby was the best picture winner. You stuck with the Academy on this one, and I broke from them with The Aviator. And it was tough because Million Dollar Baby is a movie, like I said, the emotional impact of that film, it stays with me forever. It's like Pianist in the sense it does haunt me too. But you know how I feel about The Aviator, Scorsese and Leo, that mashup in that film and that ensemble cast. It's like watching Hollywood history, in my opinion. They really made it come to life. So, I have a reverence for that movie, as you know.
Oh, yeah. And that was when my first, obviously Leo had been in stuff, but that was like where I really knew he was going to be just an absolute
talent.
Star talent, top fiver, type guy. Yeah. And that was definitely the start of that. 2006, Crash. And we both crashed in that pod because neither one of us wanted to pick that one. Before we get into our picks from that, between Crash and Chicago, what would you rank as the worst movie we covered?
Chicago's worse than Crash.
I have Chicago at 11 and Crash at 10 as far as movies that we discuss. But tell me what you did pick for 06.
06, I went with Brokeback Mountain. And I still feel good about that. I just feel like it's a film that deserved to be honored. you know, yeah. And I feel like the Academy played catch up later on with Moonlight and Milk giving Sean Penn that best actor and Moonlight the win. Nothing against Moonlight. It's just this film maybe was too early for them in that sense.
I will say this decade definitely gave birth to more what would be considered controversial mm-hmm. topics.
Absolutely.
You had LGBTQIA plus movies that started to come on the scene. And people be a lot more accepting than, you know, that Hollywood ever would have imagined previously. And Brokeback was a big start into that. I went with Syriana talking about as far as how politics shaped some movies that came out during this time. And that's a movie I still think that is just a brilliant job of multiple storylines coming together and not feeling too cheap as far as how those stories come together. 07, this is when you and I start to agree from about 07 on. What was our pod? And tell me you're still some of your feelings on that film.
Thank you again for suggesting Syriana. But for 07, Martin Scorsese's The Departed, he finally had his moment. We both stuck with The Departed. You're extremely high on that movie. It's in my top five of Scorsese films. I mean, what else can you say? Like, we said it all on that pod. It's so good. Yeah. There's really not a flaw in it. It's probably the best paced movie I've ever seen. I really feel that way.
It's a really bold statement, but I honestly agree with that. 2008 was No Country for Old Men, which is a great movie, but this was, mm-hmm. it's so wild. Neither one of us went that direction because of a very brilliant performance by Daniel Day-Lewis.
We both chose There Will Be Blood. And, you know, I don't think it's too controversial that we chose There Will Be Blood. I think a lot of people consider it one of the best, if not the best films of the 21st century. You know?
Yeah. And Paul Thomas Anderson is considered possibly the best director of the 21st. I mean, he's in the conversation.
The guy hasn't had a miss in his career, and that's saying something. So, and yeah, he's in my top five. So that was a fun pod, fun year for film, and a great movie to go to that we both at the same time, you know, rewatch, enjoyed talking about, and just what a legacy that movie has.
Absolutely. 2009, Slumdog Millionaire. I'd call it a fun watch, but not necessarily our favorite. In fact, the entire game for the Academy changed after this year, mostly due to both of our picks.
It did. We both went with The Dark Knight, rightfully so. And yeah, Slumdog Millionaire, you know, I hadn't seen it in so many years, and it was a fun rewatch, and I saw what allured me the first time, but golly gee, if it's not The Dark Knight, what else is it going to be?
It gets eight nominations, and yet it only walked away with the two. Just that comic book superhero snobbery on full display. 2010, our last pod, we did The Hurt Locker. And once again, you and I were in agreement.
That was another easy one. The Hurt Locker, we stuck with the Academy. It didn't, for me, it didn't have, it was, like I said at the time, it was the easiest one. Well, on top of The Dark Knight, those were the two easiest for me to pick. It didn't have much competition in my mind.
I mean, Inglourious Basterds and Up in the Air both are great, but
that was it for me. Those were the only three that are the only two other two I would consider.
So. And that was our first year with, an expanded field. Those were the movies we discussed on all our previous pods. But now let's get into why we really did this. We're going to get into our top 10 for the decade, but first we're going to mention some honorable mentions, movies that didn't make our 10 but are still movies that we thought were great from this decade.
Okay.
Mine's a little shorter list than yours, but I had Michael Clayton, Brokeback Mountain, Up in the Air, The Aviator, Suriana. I put Up in there. Thought it was one of the best animated film. The Wrestler, just because of an incredible performance. Gangs of New York. And then just a movie I completely swung and missed and forgot about, Hangover. Mm-hmm. I think we need to bring that up. Todd Phillips obviously went on to do a whole other genre by the towards the end of the next decade. But Hangover and Superbad, both great comedies. I put Pan's Labyrinth for its visuals, Children of Men, Inglourious Basterds, and of course, the first and second Lord of the Rings. What were your honorable mentions?
Some of ours are going to repeat, but that's okay. I have Gangs of New York also. I have Syriana. Gosh, I love that movie. Once again, thank you. Lost in Translation, Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers, District 9, Gladiator, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, Million Dollar Baby, Little Children, The Pianist, Burn After Reading, 25th Hour, the fantastic film that Luke mentioned, Spike Lee film that deals with post 9/11, and really the first film to truly take post 9/11 head on. And it was 2002, so it was still very raw. The Prestige, 40-Year-Old Virgin, and then Pineapple Express and Superbad. So I included three comedies as well that I really admired from that decade.
40-Year-Old Virgin, I probably gave birth to all those other films. That's a good
right.
one.
Right. Yeah, Judd Apatow, the master, one of the masters of comedy. So a great one.
Well, here we go.
The time has come, though.
Into our 10. We're going to go counting down from 10 all the way to 1. Zach, give us your number 10.
My number 10 of the decade, number 10 film, is Into the Wild.
In Alaska, the city of Alaska. Not in Alaska, in the city of Alaska, they have markets.
No, man. Alaska. I'm going to be all the way out there, all the way fucking out there, just on my own. You know, no fucking watch, no map, no axe, no nothing. Just be out there in it. You know, big mountains, rivers, sky, game. Just be out there in it, you know, in the wild. You know?
In the wild.
Just wild.
Yes.
Yeah. Sean Penn directed, wrote it. Emil Hirsch starring in the star role. True story based on a book about a man who gave away all his material possessions after he graduated college in a $35,000 to $40,000 savings account to charity, and he became a nomad on a mission to go to Alaska and live for a year basically in isolation and kind of figure out not only the meaning of his life but just the meaning of life in general on his terms. And to me, it's one of the most beautifully filmed movies I've ever seen, with such a colorful cast of characters and actors and actresses that play those roles. You know, you see people who normally would normally not be in a movie like that cast, like Vince Vaughn and Zach Galifianakis, and they really shine. And Kristen Stewart, who a lot of people aren't the biggest fan of, but I think who actually is fairly talented, gives a pretty good performance as well. And Emil Hirsch is a very underrated actor, and I'm glad he had a role in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. But the film Into the Wild itself, for me, why I consider it a top 10 of the decade is primarily the power of the visuals that Sean Penn gives with the camera, and then also the story itself, the fact that that was a true story, the fact that, you know, that young man really did do all that and he did make it to Alaska and unfortunately, you know, spoiler alert, lost his life. It's just for me, it just made me realize, you know, always appreciate nature and get outside as much as you can, things like that. So that's why it's my top 10. Into the Wild, 2007.
And, you know, there's a quote from that movie. I think he says something. Hirsch is talking to the older gentleman that won Best Supporting Actor that's in the movie.
Hal Holbrook.
He's talking to Hal Holbrook, and he talks about careers being he says some type of quote about it being some type of invention of the 21st century. And he's not really looking for careers. He's like a millennial before there were millennials.
Yeah, and he put his money. Well, he put no money where his mouth was.
He bought. He mean he went all in on that. Number 10 for me, I went with, and I really had to think about this and whether I wanted to put this or Two Towers. But I really just started to think about wrapping up a trilogy. So I went with Lord of the Ring, Return of the King. It's a large-scale masterpiece with an insanely low budget for something of that scale. One of the cleanest and most perfect ways to wrap up a trilogy, maybe in film history. We discussed, you and I, outside the pod, about what may have been the best way to wrap up a trilogy, either this or Dark Knight Rises. What Jackson and his team were able to do with such a classic book was really brilliant. I know they had source material in order to finish the vision, but it's so rewatchable, and it ends exactly the way you would want to in terms of how you feel after you finished watching it, because you went on this journey for 3 straight years with a huge cast, and the payoff at the end, it was worth it. The juice was worth the squeeze. You loved watching them finally get the ring into Mount Doom and finish the job, and I just think it's a great trilogy that will, you know, be watched. I hope that even my children will sit down and watch it, but what a great way to end it, and just incredibly shot, incredible music, and a very, very, you know, well done job by Peter Jackson.
I mean, arguably the best third film in any trilogy ever. I texted you about Dark Knight Rises, but I'd say Return of the King probably holds that mantle, and it probably always will.
Number 9, Gladiator.
Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained? Is this not why you are here?
Listen, he asked in the movie, are you not entertained? I was certainly entertained. Ridley Scott did such an incredible job. Like, with the action set pieces. And let's be honest here, Crow was on a run, an absolute heater. I mean, he was, if this was gambling, he's not leaving the table. And Maximus is just one of those characters that even 20 years later, I know people my age or guys, you know, especially being a coach, you know, you love to talk about the Coliseum and those battles, and Maximus included. But you also had Joaquin Phoenix, who has become one of the best actors around. Mm-hmm. Really kicking off his career with his portrayal of this Commodus. And it's like, it's a wildly entertaining film, and it sucks you in with all those Colosseum battles, but you really stay to watch Commodus die. And I know that sounds terrible, but I think in the end, all of that action intensity, but plus, you know, the storyline of all the troubles that befell Maximus, and for him to get his revenge per se, it will always be a movie that I love.
Well, we said on the Gladiator pod, that movie is not what it is without Joaquin Phoenix's performance and how powerful he is. I mean, the perfect co-star to Crow. I love it as well. My number 9, Luke, is Michael Clayton.
Michael. Dear Michael. Of course it's you. Who else could they send? Who else could be trusted?
I know it's a long way and you're ready to go to work. All I'm saying is wait, just wait, just
please hear me out, because this is not an episode. Relapse. Fuck up. I'm begging you, Michael, I'm begging you. Try and make believe this is not just madness, because this is not just madness. 2 weeks ago, I came out of the building, okay?
2007, Tony Gilroy wrote and directed this film. Born Identity, or Born Supremacy, Born Ultimatum writer, alum. I know you love this movie, and as you can see, I do too. I mean, Wow. So Michael Clayton is a legal drama, George Clooney in the title role, arguably the best performance of his career. In my opinion, it is, along with The Descendants. It's incredible movie. It's a legal drama unlike any I had ever seen at the time. You basically have corporate espionage going on. You have a murder. I mean, it's excellent. You have Aaron Sorkin-like dialogue that's pretty fast-paced, really coming at you. It's witty, and it's, you know, it's intelligent, and it's easy to follow. And it has maybe one of the best ending sequences, one of my favorite ending sequences, last 15 minutes of a film. You're fucked.
Oh, man, when he walks up to kill the Clinton.
Right?
Yeah.
What'd you say? I just said you're fucked. I mean, yeah.
I buried you. I've got you.
Yeah. And then the camera staying on him in the cab as he just driving through the city, finally vindicated, and he won. And I was rewatching Michael Clayton right before this pod, and I feel great about having it as my number 9 of the decade. Like I said, fantastic legal drama. Tom Wilkinson, who I'm going to talk about here in a little bit, gets nominated and gives a top-notch supporting performance. He has two monologues in this movie that I quote to Luke to this day. What else can I say? Michael Clayton, my number 9.
You know, someone from that movie I've just now realized underrated is the female character that Tom Wilkinson's so obsessed with, her case that he calls. She's gone on to – she starred in a Netflix drama that came out in the past year that had to do with a Colorado serial killer.
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
And she also is in the new – she was an HBO series or show called Run, and her name escapes me off the top of my head, but – like, she's really good. I think her name's Merritt Weaver.
Okay, yep.
And the show is called Unbelievable, but she's won primetime Emmys for, like, Nurse Jack.
She was in Marriage Story as well.
Yes. And Unbelievable, that show, her, I think it's Toni Collette is in it with her. That was one of my favorite Netflix shows of 2019. Yep. And then, you know, she's in Michael Clayton so far earlier, and like, you know, you think about the cast in that, you have the late Sidney Pollack.
Yeah,
you have a niche, Michael, a niche.
I wish I could quote Wilkinson's second monologue.
How about just his conversations with Michael's son are also incredible.
Yes about the book.
Yes.
Great movie.
It was tough for me.
Why don't you tell us your number 8?
Number 8.
Let me cry while you do.
Baby.
Kill her. Don't say that. Maggie walked through that door with nothing but guts. No chance in the world of being what she needed to be. A year and a half later, she's fighting for the championship of the world. You did that. People die every day, Frankie. Mopping floors, washing dishes. And you know what their last thought is? I never got my shot. Because of you, Maggie got her shot. If she dies today, you know what her last thought will be? I think I did all right.
The saddest film of this decade. Maybe. I mean, I can't think of something. This is just rip my heart out. Stomp on it. Put it back inside me. Read the entire book of Job to me, and then rip it out again. That's all that said, this is a great film. Eastwood, Freeman, Swank, all brilliant. And it's not the most rewatchable of this decade. I will stick by that. It's probably the saddest. But I can't imagine people watching this and not agreeing that this is a great film. Like, I have yet to find someone that I talk to about movies that you and I discuss on the pod. I've yet to find someone that said, oh, Million Dollar Baby, hate that. The only problem most people have is that it's so sad.
It's a heartbreaker. And like I told you, the New York Times had it what, number six, I think, of the century in 2017 when they did their list. So, that, I mean, it's highly regarded. And for me, it and Mystic River are Clint's best films. I mean, they're just perfect. There's not a flaw in that movie. Like, it's executed beginning to end without a hitch, without a false note. I really admire it.
And it's funny that was my number eight, because your number eight is what you picked yes. over it. So tell us about yours.
Yeah, my number eight is The Aviator.
Hey, Noah. I need you to get over to Penny's and buy me some new clothes.
Penny's isn't open.
Oh, shit.
It's 2 a.m.
Yeah, that's right. All right, well, first thing tomorrow then, all right? I need 2 new suits off the rack. 1 light, 1 dark. 3 white shirts and 3 pairs of white tennis shoes. You got that?
Yeah.
No. Make it Woolworths.
Woolworths.
No. Penny's.
All right, then. I'll get into it as soon as I can, Howard.
No, right. Noah, do you have a recorder?
No.
Are you recording this conversation?
No.
Okay. I trust you.
Howard.
Listen, I need those suits first thing tomorrow, all right?
All right.
Wait. Did I say Penny?
2004. Martin Scorsese, Leonardo DiCaprio, John C. Reilly, Alec Baldwin, Alan Alda. Gosh, who else? What is Kate Blanchett, the girl that plays Ava Gardner. She was big for a little while. I just can't think of her name. She's in Pearl Harbor. I can't think of her name. Either way, ensemble cast. The Aviator tells the story of Howard Hughes. If you don't know who Howard Hughes is or who he was in every sense of the word an aviation giant in this country, and the airline industries, for better or worse, are what they are now because of him. He revolutionized them. He took away the monopoly that they were at the time. No more one airline dominating the skies, which is how things were in this country back then. And he unfortunately suffered from some serious mental illnesses, mainly horrible obsessive compulsive disorder. And what I love about this movie is you get the story of him through Leo's just masterful performance. You just watch him degrade and decline right in front of your eyes, his life and his body and who he is and just his identity. I mean, and at that same time, as he's falling apart and kind of descending into madness with his OCD, you see the bits of brilliance when he's able to control himself. He has his and you're rooting for him because you know he has a tough rap, and he's getting a bad draw, a bad card, and he fights. That's one thing about him. He fights to the end. And it's unfortunate, kind of, well, not unfortunate, it's just sad how it has a sad ending as well, because you see that he's not really ever going to get better. And the thing, like I said, the thing I love about this movie is not only Leo's performance, which I think it's one of his best even to this day, and he's put up some great ones, Scorsese's direction and Robert Richardson's cinematography. It's one of the prettiest films you'll ever see. Like, the way they take you through each decade of Hollywood history, it's excellent.
Yeah, I'm with you on all those points, and especially when you look at the cast: Leo, Blanchett, Riley, Kate Beckinsale.
That's who it was.
Baldwin, Alda, Suri, and Holm. Gwen Stefani was in it. Jude Law, Willem Dafoe. Like, it had a lot of people in it that people would recognize. And like we said, this was the beginning of the Leo rocket that would continue to climb. And I say this as I look over Zach's shoulder. He's got a poster of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood with Leo staring down, another movie that shows a glimpse into Hollywood's past. But tell me about your number seven, done by, what I would say a top 10 director that's currently working.
Oh, absolutely. My number seven is Children of Men.
mosques.
The Homeland Security Bill is ratified. After 8 years, British borders will remain closed. The deportation of illegal immigrants will continue. Good morning. Our lead story.
The world was stunned today by the death of Diego Ricardo, the youngest person on the planet. Baby Diego was stabbed outside a bar in Buenos Aires after refusing to sign an autograph.
Witnesses at the scene say that Diego spat in the face of a fan who asked for an autograph. He was killed in the ensuing...
The 2009 Alfonso Cuarón film. Wow. I watched this for the first time for that pod that we did, for the 09 pod, and God almighty, it's one of the best films I've ever seen, Luke. I mean, the Chivo, Emmanuel Lubezki is the DP on that film, and what he did is revolutionary. The one-shot takes, the documentary style, how it's following Clive Owen around London, which they shot on location in London, and they made it, they turned it into that dystopian hell. I don't know how they pulled this film off. To me, it's just a cinematic marvel. Everything about it, it's so technically flawless, and Alfonso Cuarón is a master director, and I mean, gosh, Gravity, if Gravity is a technical feat, watch this movie, is what I will say.
It's a great one. Clive Owen, the best movie Clive Owen's ever been in, and he's been in great movies.
So very underrated actor who's fallen off, oddly, you know, who had that moment from 2000 to 2009, really, and that was it.
Yeah, we won't talk about him much in the next decade. My number 7 is Memento. Is it confusing? Can you get lost in it? Absolutely. But just listen to Nolan explain his process on this clip.
And my approach to doing that was to effectively tell the story backwards. That way, when we meet a character, we don't know, just like the protagonist, how he's met that person, whether he's even met that person before, or whether or not they should be trusted, that kind of thing. So the story is basically told backwards. It's basically told as a series of flashbacks that go further and further back in time. So what I did is I alternated between these color sequences that are intensely subjective. Everything in the color sequences is from Leonard's point of view. We're always in his head, at least to begin with. We alternate with these black and white sequences that, at least to begin with, are objective.
Best way to draw it is as a hairpin, like that. That's basically the end of the movie. This stuff is the black and white stuff. This is color. And this is running backwards as a series of jumps. And what we do is we cut between the two the whole way through. So we alternate scene here, scene there, scene there, scene there, scene there, scene there, and they meet towards the end of the film.
It's just brilliant vision and storytelling. Like, how he thought up this process is unbelievable. We need more out of this, like... Film today needs more people like this, more vision like this. I realize that some of it he adapted from something his brother was working on, but he finished the entire movie script before his brother ever finished what his kind of concept was. He made this movie with $9 million. $9 million. I mean, people will always be torn on this movie. You either really love it or you really find it to be absolutely confusing and you hate it. And that's just what Nolan is. But I think this is a classic. When it comes to carrying out a vision, using different camera techniques to carry out that vision, in that clip he explained the difference between color and black and white and where he was trying to meet in between in the scenes. And just if all that planning out, every minuscule detail, Nolan is just a genius. He really is a genius. He doesn't hold anything back. He always goes for it. And I can't, like, Tenet can't get here soon enough. I am dying for that to get here, figuratively, but I know that we have to wait until this virus slows down.
Two thoughts. Nolan, obviously one of the most original inventive filmmakers in the history of Hollywood. And according to Quentin Tarantino, he saved filming on film, 35 millimeter, not going completely to digital, which is incredible. Second thought, supposedly, Luke, on the Memento Special Edition DVD, the second disc, there's like a puzzle and a couple games you got to play. And once you get to through all that, answer all that correctly, it gives you the movie in order, like an actual order. Yeah, right. I'd love to see that.
I don't know if it'd be as good.
No, it wouldn't, but I'd still love to, you know, I'd still love to see it.
Absolutely. I mean, from the opening scene when the Polaroid is going back into the camera, you're hooked. Mm-hmm. Right? I was hooked. I was like, what's going on?
I love the movie. I love it like you. I didn't think you were going to name it Best Picture winner, but like I said, I respect that. We are to number six, though. My number six, Luke, you kind of previewed it or kind of hinted, is In the Bedroom.
Favor was, you want a grieving contest, go find someone else.
Oh, I know how you grieve. Go have another beer.
The hell is that supposed to mean? What do you know? You know nothing. You don't know what I go through.
No, I don't know what you go through, Matt. Or if you go through anything. But that's your choice, dear, not mine.
Goddamn right it is. My choice is not to scream at the world. Maybe one of us has to be reasonable around here. You ever think of that?
Reasonable? Gee, Matt, I don't know about you, but I miss my son.
2001, Todd Field film, written and directed. He adapted it from a short story. It's Tom Wilkinson, Sissy Spacek, Marissa Tomei, and Nick Stahl. And like I've kind of talked about, if you listen to the pod where I awarded it, it's one of the most haunting and gripping portraits of grief and revenge, basically, and then ultimately revenge that I've ever seen. And it's a film that for two acts, it's one genre. And then in the third act with just one quick scene, it turns into something else. And it's executed so well. And Todd Field, like I've said before, I really admire this film and Little Children, and I wish he would make more. And supposedly, I think he will next year or whenever this is over, he's supposed to with Daniel Craig. And what I love about him is he kind of Coen Brothers-esque, how he moves the camera, where he places the camera, and how he lets that tell the story. And he gets top-notch performances from his actors because he was an actor. And his style really reminds me a lot of Kubrick in a lot of ways. And I admire him in this film. I rewatched it two nights ago, I think, Luke, just to make sure that I wanted it in my top 10. Because, you know, I rewatched it for that pod, too. And I feel the same.
Here's something I forgot to mention when you discussed this film, mostly because the time, we didn't have a lot of time to really get into that. But when you let me borrow this, I don't know if you remember my apartment on Leverett. I had the like table side turning like basketball shaped television. Mm-hmm. I also had it in my dorm my freshman year. So mm-hmm. I had that in there, but it wasn't connected to cable. So the only thing I would do in my room is watch movies. And you let me borrow this movie, and I watched it, I think, three straight nights. and people out there are like, why would you do that? But it's just...
it's that good.
It's just really good. And it was it's just a movie that I thought it calmed me down, yet kept me on the edge of my seat all in the same. And if a movie can do both, elicit both emotions out of you and both feelings out of you, that's a powerful movie. And Tom Wilkinson, possibly the most underrated actor we've ever discussed on this pod, because if I said his name and I polled nine people, I don't know if they could pick his picture out of a Google image lineup. And I think that's a travesty because he's so good. So good in that movie too. My number six, a very recent movie for our listeners as far as hearing us discuss it, was The Hurt Locker.
Secondary.
Shit. Take
cover. Get in the wall. Get in the wall.
Like we discussed on that pod, had little to no buzz, and then it just steals the show come Oscar time. And this, it wasn't because there was some type of push for a female director to win. I think it was just that good. You had some pretty novice actors until, and as far as their total body of work, and then they all do extremely well. You know, one of which, in Renner, I'd say he's gone on to be a top 10 actor in Hollywood for some people. He's just, he's very good on screen. And then that trifecta of Bigelow, Bowl, and Aykroyd, that showed that you could have little to no money, but if you have expert talent in those three areas, writing, directing, and cinematography, you can create something so special that carries on and it's such a classic. I think it's one of the best war films of all time, and it doesn't really ever get political. You know, it's just these soldiers doing their job, but it also shows some of the side effects of having to do that job, and thus is the nature of war. I hated placing it outside of my top five, but I think you and I can both agree, as far as the movies we've already discussed, the movies we've already discussed are great, but that just shows how powerful we think the next five are.
Yeah. As we get into the next five, Luke and I do have the same next five movies, just not in the same order. And that's got to tell you, yes, we hold these in the highest regard for this decade. I'll lead us off. My number five, Luke, is No Country for Old Men.
Okay. This is the best I can do. Call it.
I know G was crazy when I saw you sitting there. I know exactly what was in store for me.
Call it.
No. I ain't gonna call it.
Call it.
The coin don't have no say. It's just you.
Well, I got here the same way the coin did.
Coen Brothers classic. I really enjoyed doing that pod with you on No Country, even though we awarded There Will Be Blood. Doesn't matter. This movie is, it's so scary with Bardem's performance. And then just how bleak everything ends up being, and just the tone, and, you know, or obviously Roger Deakins behind the camera, you get something special. I think filming there in the Southwest US, New Mexico, and a little of certain parts of Texas that Tommy Lee Jones convinced them to go to. And people can complain about the third act, but it's got an ending that I still wonder about. I still don't really understand it, or what quite happened, or what I'm supposed to take from it, because it's that powerful. And not many movies do that to me, where I'm like, what was I supposed to get out of that? You know?
Right.
But No Country for Old Men, my number five.
And I had it at four. I had No Country at four because call it, Zach. I mean, this movie, it's just another another addition to, you know, we have the Coen brothers, two incredible writer directors, and this is, I would say, maybe their masterpiece. Like, you talk about Deakins, those wide shots of those planes. And I got a quote from Deakins here. It says, "I feel every shot, every camera move, every frame, and the way you frame something and the choice of lens, I see all those things are really important on every shot. If you shoot with a billion cameras, then there's no perspective." And like, he gave you a ton of perspective. And then the eerie moments with Bardem, maybe the greatest villain of all time. And then all the little creative choices by the Coens. You talk about the very ambiguous third act, the limited music to set that tone. I've only seen that in a handful of movies, and they mastered it. And I'm like, I'm starting to think this is their best film by a mile, like a literal mile, because it's so good. It encapsulates all the things that they've gotten right over the years and pairs it with really good performances, really good camera work. And when we did this pod, it was truly the hardest one for me. And I think that just shows how fond we were of the one that we chose. Yeah, so I was very close with you in that regard.
I want you still to watch Inside Llewyn Davis and then rewatch Fargo, and then you can tell me out of the three which
I've
is
seen.
Their best.
Well, I've seen Fargo, but yes, I will watch Inside Llewyn Davis because that I believe is our next year, right?
No, it's 2013. We got a little while.
All right, got a little while on that regard. My number five, which is another movie that you have it all the way in your top three, but my number five is Zodiac.
Zodiac had to have known Darlene Farron, right? Yes, because of the phone calls on the night of her murder. Because of the Vallejo file, we know that Darlene knew a man named Lee.
Yes.
So all coincidence aside, Robert, how can you be sure that Lee Allen is a Lee from this file? Now, Vallejo is a small town, but it's not that small. How do you put the two of them together?
This is a case that's covered both Northern and Southern California, with victims and suspects spread over hundreds of miles. Would you agree?
Yes.
Darlene Farron worked at the Vallejo House of Pancakes on the corner of Tennessee and Carroll. Arthur Lee Allen lived in his mother's basement on Fresno Street. Door to door, that is less than 50 yards.
Is that true?
I've walked it.
I vote this as the most underrated film of the century. I said it, Zach, of the century. I think the casting in this film was terrific. Gyllenhaal, Downing, and Ruffalo give some of the best performances of their careers, and they're not the only ones. Like the John Carroll Lynch, who plays, you know, one of the prime suspects, his performance is chilling. Fincher's attention to detail has always been a trademark of his, and he's so meticulous and so methodical in using every single little detail to develop characters and the story. You know, he's done Fight Club, Seven, Gone Girl, Social Network, but this might be his best movie that he ever did. And you and I are both fans of Mindhunter. On Netflix, and I think that movie kind of that show comes from this movie as far as tone and how they tell the story. And for our listeners out there, this is a long movie, but it is a movie that I highly recommend watching, because chances are you missed out on it back when it came out, and I think so many people did. And now when people go back and watch it, it's like, what happened and what were we doing?
Good question. Well, Luke, I had Zodiac at number three. You just said it's the most underrated movie of the 21st century. I second that, having it in my number three spot. Zodiac was released in 2007, and Luke said it best. David Fincher controls the light. Morgan Freeman, this is a Morgan Freeman quote. He controls the lighting, the camera, and the actors, their performances, like, where everyone is, the staging, like minute to the detail, like as fine a detail as he can. And it shows in his work. This film, I've said this to you before. I said Gone Girl and Social Network are perfect. This film's perfect. Seven, pretty close to perfect. Fight Club is perfect. The guy, because of his attention to detail and how smart he is, he doesn't make shitty movies. Like, and not even your average movie that you'd go to the theater and watch and say, oh, that was all right. I mean, these are elite. And this movie, I think I would agree with you. It probably is his best, just because the subject matter, I think, really stays. Well, Social Network stays with you too in a lot of ways, but this is an unsolved freaking serial killer. And, you know, that's going to bother on a lot of levels. And the performances, I think this is Mark Ruffalo's best performance of his career. Maybe top.
It's arguable. I mean, I really, Spotlight, I enjoyed him in.
I think he's better in this than Spotlight, though.
There is something about his character. There's something perfect about the balance between him, Gyllenhaal, and Downey, and that's probably because they hit the actual real-life people they're portraying right on the head. But you have, like, Ruffalo, who's like that cop that just – he doesn't really – he hates the media. He doesn't want to tip his hand. He's very pessimistic. And then it's like Downey's like playing essentially Tony Stark because Paul Avery's like a rock star, says whatever he wants type thing. And then Gyllenhaal's like the, I'm going to figure this out guy.
It's the Boy Scout.
Right. And like the scene where he goes to that one dude's house and like sees his little basement and stuff. That's chill. Like you think he's got the Zodiac there, and obviously, you know, it's still on, like you said, it's open-ended. So many times that movie, you're like, that's the guy. And then it's not the guy, but here's one of the, when you talk about details, there's one part where I think one killing takes place and it's some random cop's birthday. And they follow that up when they, to show how much time has passed, because there's a line about like, happy birthday. He's like, yeah, better than the last one or something. And it's like Fincher puts all these little things in within the movie over and over again that are supposed to develop everything.
His research, it's like basically from what I read, they researched, they investigated this case, him, the producers, the writers, they all did that themselves, and they found stuff the cops missed. Like they did. And I would say I think they kind of lean that Arthur Lee Allen is the killer, because
that guy points to his picture in Canada.
Yeah. And the way, what Fincher basically said is, hey, if we're going to be implicating someone, we're going to do this right. We're going to do the research. And that's what they did. And what you have is a masterpiece.
Yep. So I already have discussed my number four with No Country for Old Men. Give us your number four.
My number four, Luke, is The Departed.
Your hand? Steady. That's one thing I figured out about myself in prison. My hand does not shake. Ever.
All right, turn off your cell phones. Fitzy's got the chicken. Check your weapons.
With automatic weapons. For his own good, tell Bruce Lee and the Karate Kids, none of us are carrying automatic weapons. Because here, in this country, it don't add inches to your dick. You get a life sentence for it.
Which, you have a little further up than I do, but... Man, The Departed, obviously, you know, everyone knows Scorsese is my favorite director. I have two of his films from this decade in my top 10. You know, nothing new there. The Departed is just, like I said to Luke, it's the most immaculately best-paced film I've ever seen in my life. And someone kind of pointed this out to me, but I find this more reflective of Scorsese movies. They're like, oh, it's kind of almost like a comedy, which made me laugh, but there is a lot of comedy in it, and there's a lot of comedy in Scorsese, like his gangster films. That's just natural, and it always works, and it's always hilarious. So yes, this is a funny movie, despite its brutal, violent content and where the story takes you, but We've talked about it before, and I know this is why you have it so high on your list, the performances. I mean, Leo, Damon, Jack, you know, Alec Baldwin, Martin Sheen, Marky Mark Wahlberg. You just, everyone is on their A game. Ray Winstone is Mr. French. It's just all the way around, you know, like, and it never drags. Vera Farmiga,
even Anthony Anderson,
yes, he, James Badge Dale, you know, you come to work every day like in bed in Poland, you know, it's just I love this movie. We love this movie. I wish I could have had it higher. I really do, but I'm glad you did that for us.
Yeah, I had this at number two. Can we rewatch it right now? I said it back then. It's the best movie that we covered, in my opinion, as far as the best picture winners from that decade. Scorsese was, is, and always is going to be a legend. The movie has arguably two top five actors of all time. And, you know, of course, a movie with Jack is going to be kind of funny. Like, even One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which is just a terrible, sad ending. I mean, it's funny. He's funny. Like, how he does his characters is funny. And you said it, but it has an incredible pace and an excitement that just keeps you, like, sucked to the screen. This was before I ever had this was right when I think I got a cell phone. There's no way in hell I'm taking my eyes off the screen to look at a phone, because, you know, I would say on first watch, this is the most thrilling film from that decade in terms of, like, oh wait, are they gonna catch him? Oh wait, is he gonna get caught? Like, when are they gonna get caught? That was the biggest thing between Damon and Leo. And then when it came to that big showdown, when you finally think one's got the other, boom, you're absolutely stunned. It's a riveting masterpiece, and it was a fun experience to watch. And hats off to Scorsese. I mean, you have those posters in your room. You know, to me, he made something so powerful and so incredible that the Academy couldn't even turn him away. Like, this was so good that they weren't going to snub him this time.
It was his time, and I forgot to mention, one of the best third acts and endings you'll ever see in any movie. Like, I said it before, one of the best movie going experiences I've ever had, watching it live in the theater.
I agree. You're number three. We're on to number three. I've already brought up I've already brought up your movie. For number three, you had Zodiac. Any other thoughts on that?
I think we said it best that David Fincher is, I mean, top 3 to 5 working directors in Hollywood, and I don't think that's in any way a stretch. But
are you shocked that I ended up with him in my top five? And if you look at my next movie is, for my number three, Christopher Nolan in my top five. Were you shocked by that?
I was not. I'm shocked they're lower, that you don't have them higher, actually.
Well, I mean, that just shows how much, what I think about The Departed. Yeah, but so my number three is The Dark Knight.
Hmm? You know what I noticed? Nobody panics when things go according to plan. Even if the plan is horrifying. If tomorrow I tell the press that, like, a gangbanger will get shot, or a truckload of soldiers will be blowing up, nobody panics. Because it's all part of the plan. But when I say that one little old mare will die, well, then everyone loses their minds. Introduce a little anarchy. Upset the established order, and everything becomes chaos. I'm an agent of chaos. Oh, and you know the thing about chaos? It's fear. You live, you die. Now we're talking.
I'm so serious. Like, the legend that was Heath Ledger, it's going to live on through this movie, I think. He did a lot of great movies, but this movie, we're at this juncture where like superhero and comic book movies, they're dominating box office. And I'm a huge fan of them. And people can't get enough of them. But Nolan created an entirely different version of them, entirely different trilogy. Not only was it entertaining, but it was also critically acclaimed. And that's quite a feat in its own. I know, you know, we talk about Scorsese's quote about Marvel movies, but I think this is even a comic book movie that he would enjoy watching because, like, the filming, the editing, the acting, the storytelling, they're all spot on. And we discussed how much this changed the future of the Academy. It just opened their eyes to that there's more than just, you know, there's more out there as far as genres that can be great movies. I think some of the great strengths of this film is the way it combines this realism and this naturalism. And then, but on the flip side, you have all the stunts and set pieces and explosions and trucks flipping that you wouldn't normally get in a summer blockbuster. It's very rare you have action blockbuster type stuff paired with just some of the best scenes that you'll see. It's easily the best comic book movie of all time. And I still believe you could have taken, I bet you could have taken any comic book character, and this may be a stretch, but you could have taken any character, put it in Nolan's hands, let him do his thing. I think you still would have got incredible results with this cast and how they did it. It was just spot on. It's not too far-fetched. And, you know, a lot of people hate comic book movies because it's an alien and this, that, and the other, but it was almost so realistic how they showed his version of anarchy with the Joker. It was brilliant.
Well, you had it at number three. I have The Dark Knight at number two. 2008 film, like you said, Christopher Nolan. A grounded, dark, kind of noir approach to Batman, because Batman Begins is exceptional in its own work, in its own way as well. And yeah, I just, Heath gives the performance of a lifetime, and one that I still think about, and every time I rewatch it, I just, how did he pull that off? How did they pull any of it off? Because it's another film, I would say, just like The Departed, the pacing as good as you will ever see in any movie. It does not drag. It's, you know, it's a story of Gotham and a showdown between two men, essentially. And I've never seen something pulled off in the way that Nolan did that. And you can say that about every movie he makes.
It's so crazy. They could have ended that movie right when, like, Rachel dies and Dent goes, and then you could have ended it there. It's still an amazing movie. And then you still get 20 more minutes or 30 more minutes of holy crap moments. It was I might watch it tonight.
You should. I think closer to 45 minutes is that third act. And that would have set it up perfect, like cliffhanger for the sequel, you know. But man, no, thank God they didn't let us off there.
Glad they kept going.
Well, my friend, we're down to number one.
And we have the same.
We do. This was pretty easy, don't you think? Our number one.
There Will Be Blood. I abandoned my boy! Yes, it was.
I abandoned my child.
It's can Daniel Day-Lewis come out of retirement already and just make another classic movie?
Did you just tell me how to run my family?
It might be more important now that you've proven the field. We're offering to buy you out.
One night, I'm going to come to you inside of your house, wherever you're sleeping, and I'm going to cut your throat.
What are you talking about? Have you gone crazy, Daniel? I heard what you said. What did you say?
Don't tell me about my son.
Why are you acting insane and threatening to cut my throat?
Don't tell me about my son.
I'm not telling you anything. I'm asking you to be reasonable. If I've offended you, I apologize.
We'll see what I can do. I have a competition in me. I want no one else to succeed. I hate most people.
That part of me is gone. Working and not succeeding. All my failures has left me I just don't care.
Well, if it's in me, it's in you. There are times when I look at people and I see nothing worth liking. I want to earn enough money I can get away from everyone.
I'm going to come to you in the middle of the night and I'm going to cut your throat.
Yeah,
why are you talking about cutting my throat?
Yeah, what are you talking about, Daniel?
If I offended you, I apologize.
Maybe he's the greatest villain. It just depends on which side you sit there, but
he's definitely a villain.
Why
do you love this movie, Luke?
Obviously, the number one reason would be that I think Daniel Day-Lewis' performance is the greatest performance in all film history, and that's just my opinion. I just think his emotion, his expressions, just his little movements that he does, everything he does to embody Daniel Plainview is so incredible. And you sit back and you watch and you go, God, he really poured, like he does in every role, his heart into that role, and it's so powerful. And then you pair him with Paul Thomas Anderson, who he's gonna come up in our next decade of, you know, when we get in, you know, and like the master. We're gonna talk about that. It's just his ability to create masterpiece film you talk to people who love film and you start mentioning some of his movies, they're gonna go, oh, that's a great movie, because that's what Paul Thomas Anderson does. And this movie, it came out in a year where you had two such great contenders between it and No Country for Old Men, and I'm still puzzled of why they didn't go with this movie. But I ultimately have to think that maybe it was just the Coen brother. You know, they just loved the way they told that story. But this story is so powerful too, and some of the shots are similar. It's weird how similar they are in that regard. But just Daniel Day-Lewis, hands down, is incredible, and Paul Dano is no slouch.
I like Dylan Fraser as well as his son, H.W. Yeah. Plainview. Why I put it as number one for me, you already mentioned, yes, Daniel Day-Lewis's performance, and I'm with you. It probably is the best of all. I'm not quite there yet, but I'm close. It probably is. But as far as Paul Thomas Anderson, when I watch this movie, I feel like I'm there in 1929 and then in 1936. And I feel like I'm literally there. They put me in that time period, but just how the great, you know, Robert Elswit filmed it and won for this. He did top notch work, and he really time traveled me to that time, honestly. And I felt like I was in those oil fields with him. And it's such a it's haunting in a different way. The story, you know, it really lingers with you just because of his performance and where Daniel's life goes, kind of the turn it takes, the fact that he does get what he wants, but I don't think I'd call him happy by any sense of the word. And
men that aspire for such greatness, one of their things is that they never quite hit it. There's a famous quote. I can't think off the top of my head what millionaire it was, but someone else asked him, how much money, what's the amount of money that will make you happy? And he said, one more dollar. And it's always one more dollar. And Daniel's like, he's that guy. There was nothing he could be. You know, there's coaches like that. Saban's never going to be satisfied. He could win 10 straight, and he's never going to feel it, which is sad. It seems sad, but that's just what makes them great. And I think Daniel really
– and his only his only people skills are for manipulation, you know, and extort people.
He says it in the movie, I don't like people.
Yeah, so that's why he's even more compelling to me for that reason, the fact that he doesn't like humanity, but he has enough people skills to get what he wants. But Paul Thomas Anderson, if you're not familiar with this film or any of his films, check this out. Check Magnolia out. Check Inherent Vice, which we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about The Master. Phantom Thread, I have not seen, but it'll come down later in the pods. He's brilliant, and he has been snubbed from winning striking Academy Gold, and he is long overdue.
I did see recently MGM has picked up his next film, so it's supposed to be younger crowd,
like 60s or 70s period piece, I think. So
can't wait.
I heard it compared to kind of like Magnolia ensemble cast. With that time period, you know, it'll be great. This was fun, man. I enjoyed this one.
Oh, yeah. It's great to discuss a whole decade of a lot of films we just went to go back and watch. Any other thoughts on the aughts and this 9-year gap?
Just a transformative decade for film, and I encourage anyone, if there's any film we mentioned that you haven't seen in our top tens or our honorable mentions, please go out there, watch them, and just jump into this decade if you're not very familiar with it. You're going to find some real gems.
Thoughts going into the next decade? I think there's a lot of movies that I'm not going to side with the Academy on.
This next decade, along with the 90s, it's my favorite, Luke. I've been working on my top 10 for the next decade, and it's even harder, like way harder in my opinion, because every year, I think there's maybe 2 or 3 years we're going to cover where it's, we may have 4 or 5 that we're fond of, and that's it. But after that, every year, it's a brutal competition.
Oh, yeah. To preview what's to come on And the Award Goes To, our next list of movies will be going into The King's Speech, The Artist, Argo, 12 Years a Slave, Birdman, Spotlight, Moonlight, The Shape of Water, Green Book, and Parasite. I know you're real excited for the next one.
Not as excited as I am for The Artist, but yes.
So that perfect segue into ending our show today. Next time, and the award goes to the 83rd Academy Award winner for Best Picture, The King's Speech, starring Colin Firth, who wins Best Actor that year as well. Zach's always been tough on this movie. I can't wait to see. I'm Luke Shoemaker.
And I'm Zach King.
And thank you for listening. And the award goes to...